Folks, linear thinking is a buzzkill to the dream. And in his book, Beyond the Doors of Perception, Plant Intelligence and the Imaginal Realm into the Dreaming of Earth, Stephen Harrod Buhner shares a big understanding of life. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Stephen, welcome, and thank you again for not only joining us here on Tributaries, but writing this quite brilliant and relatable book, Plant Intelligence and the Imaginal Realm.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me on again. This is great fun.
We're just going to dive in, as you do, with your book. And the ability to overlook is crashing down all around us. And this involves the search for meaning going beyond the linear cause and effect. There's a whole springtime of self-awareness going on for humankind.
We're in really interesting times, as the Chinese curse has it, you know. May you live in interesting times, and we certainly are. And I think one of the things that I've noticed the most, I've been thinking a lot lately, you know, because I'm 62, and in 1980, there was 100 million fewer people than there are today in the United States. And that's put so much tremendous pressure on the environment, on cities, on social relationships. And we're facing so much pressure on ecological systems, and even of the ecological systems that we call our culture, our sociability with each other. And the thing that I've noticed increasingly since about the year 2000 is people feel that things are sort of moving out of control in so many different ways, and they don't really know what to do about it. And so there's this sort of low-level hysteria that's running through everything, and all of us are struggling in whatever ways we can to sort of come to terms with that. And the thing that I think is really important is that we begin to directly grapple with the deeper meanings that are starting to flow into all of our lives and figure out what we're going to do about it.
Not to say that it isn't a tough journey or it's not difficult, but the system, that self, that beautiful self-organizing system that is us, that is Earth, that is universe, it's the default. You know, the default of big government falling apart is, okay, we've got to take hold of this in our own community. The big pharma, we need to have a little garden in our yard. You know, all of these things give way. And is speaking to the difficulty, it was just reminding me of going to yoga class at Richard Freeman, who was extremely popular worldwide. So I'd go and put my yoga mat down and have space, and then someone would come next to me, and that was fine. But then someone else would come even more next to me. I could just feel myself going, why are you there? You know, and there's no room for you there. And then, you know, sure enough, by the time yoga class started and I started breathing, then there was room for everyone, and it was all okay again.
Yeah, we're in this kind of strange scenario where the sort of the rational based structures of our culture, of government, of business, of a lot of things that have been in place, I mean, many of them, which really did come out of the 19th century, that they're running up against sort of these limits that they aren't really built to deal with. And behind all of that, underneath all of that, is the natural systems that have been here for 4.5 billion years, the Earth ecosystem, these sort of self-generating, nonlinear, organic structures and life forms. And what we're finding is that, and as I go through in the book over and over again, I quote Einstein considerably in this book, especially his statement where he said, we have to use The problems that are facing us cannot be solved by the same kind of thinking that created them. And even in your little description about that, or the description of that tiny event of just being in yoga class, where you were in one kind of thinking, and to be able to deal with the pressures that you began to experience, you had to shift to a different way of processing information and responding. And then when you did that, you began to find your way out of that feeling of pressure. So it's kind of inherent in all of us who are struggling with this to start to find a way to shift our thinking in very specific ways. And that's one of the things I talk about extensively in the book, the necessity for that and really what that different kind of thinking is.
Moving into that different kind of thinking, obviously there are, you know, there are many ways to do it. There are some people that find themselves there before they even know consciously that they want to make a change. And you speak a lot about the opening of the gates, opening of that gating process and the processes that go on in the brain in order to accommodate these shifts. And I'm wondering if you would just, you know, open up here by talking about that.
Well, one of the things that I've, in all of my books, written about very consistently is, and this one even more so, is how we're trained from very early life to orient ourselves towards surfaces. And that kind of orienting towards surfaces, there's a marvelous phrase from a German poet, Gottfried Benn, that I have in there, where he says, you know, as a result, people in Western cultures, especially the United States, have lost access to the metaphysical background of the world. And I just think that's a wonderful way of putting it. And children naturally are very open to the metaphysical background of the world, and they have to be very specifically trained over and over and over again before they begin to reorient themselves towards surfaces. And the problem with surfaces is that once you oriented yourself that way, you begin to lose touch with the meaning of things. You know, there's, you know, you just see a chair, and there's thousands of different kinds of chairs, but there's a quality to chairs. There's a meaning inside them, hidden inside that apparently superficial surface form, the metaphysical background of the chair, where each one is slightly different. And so to basically get there, I talk in, you know, in my older book, Secret Teachings of Plants, about rekindling heart perception. And this, I approach it from a somewhat different orientation, and that's talking about the doors of perception are what neuroscientists who had read Aldous Huxley and William Blake then began to call sensory gating channels, which is the information that flows into us from the world through our sensory portals, whether it's visual or taste or sound or even the feeling sense. You know, how does this restaurant feel when you go into it, that sort of thing, that we're surrounded by, inundated in, immersed in, embedded within these trillions of bits of sensory flows that are coming in all of the time. And our neural network gates those out. They actually, at each step along the way, they more and more of it is sort of gated out as being unimportant until just a tiny bit reaches our conscious mind. So one of the things that happens in children and many people that have more open gating is that they take in a lot more of those sensory bits. And in each side, inside each one of those sensory bits, there's really particular meanings. They're actually, they contain message material from the heart of the world. And so by moving away from surfaces toward the deeper metaphysical background, opening ourselves up like that, we become aware of these flows of meaning, literally currents of meaning that flow through the world all of the time. And our ability to sense meaning, it's one of the most important sensory mechanisms we have that enables us to navigate through the world. It's like I quote Alice Walker in one part in the book where she said, our sense of taste is crucial. And the first time an old black granny in Alabama said that her greens tasted like water, the country should have come to a halt. Because
yes.
Our sense of taste tells us about the food that we're eating. And everybody's commented so much now on the tastelessness of fruits and vegetables of various sorts. But nevertheless, and then she has a great line. She says, we've eaten poisoned warnings by the ton. Isn't that beautiful?
That is beautiful. And, you know, it's getting back to that word interesting, looking at how the information flow is on hyperdrive with, you know, there's so much information that's coming at us that we see on the computer, etc. And so in a way, it's only fitting that children are more and more now being schooled to look, you know, to be surface creatures. And I just saw a headline the other day that read, kids with less structured activities reach their goals quicker. And that, of course, is the difference between being schooled and being educated. And goals right now, I think they're probably on an endangered list somewhere for kids.
That thing about, you know, that's a big thing I explore in the whole book. And that thing about the information that we get is really just another kind of surface. And very few people are willing to spend the time to go below the surface of the information to find the deeper meanings that are embedded in the structure of the information and the linguistics that are used, and then to be able to internally sit with that information and in contemplation, and to be able to then integrate it and craft a response. And that's really, in a way, the nature of education versus schooling. Education is human beings encountering meaning and then sitting in contemplation with those meanings over time until they become more of a whole interactive person with the metaphysical background of the world, with the meanings that flow through the world, and they begin to orient themselves toward the meanings that most call them. I mean, there's a natural response in every human being about certain things have interestingness to them.
And it's individual.
And it's very individual, and that's what education is, allowing that movement. So some portions of the homeschool movement have really tried to embrace that. Of course, other parts of it have done exactly the opposite. But that dynamic, that was really the essence of what was called a liberal education. And when you look at the way children naturally are, all living organisms, I mean, one of the things I do in the book is I look at how it works across species. So there's a real similarity between baby ducks and baby kittens and puppies and human children. There's, because that state of wonder and curiosity that they're in, it's an ecological innovation of incredible long standing, and it serves a function, that willingness to encounter the world and explore with sensory gates very open in that incredible wonder. And the children begin to find where their natural interest lies, and they begin to educate themselves, and they begin to become this whole person, what I consider of as really a truly informed citizen, who then begins to engage with their culture, the world, and to bring their unique gifts to those places. And, you know, I suppose that's one of the reasons why a young French protester many years ago, she had this great sign that a friend told me about, and it said, contemplation is the first act of disobedience.
Absolutely. Well, it's laughable at this point, I'm sure, to our audience as well, to think of human beings as being the superior intelligence on this planet. And as you do mention in your book, all of life shares at their core self-awareness, intelligence, and search for meaning. And, you know, who would have ever thought that plants are searching for meaning?
Well, 4-year-olds. naturally know that. They know plants have intelligence and personality. All children instinctively know that everything is intelligent and aware and alive and has a personality. And again, they have to be trained out of that perspective quite vigorously for them to give it up. You know, the thing is that we're living in the midst of an industrialized culture that was created out of a 19th century perspective on the nature of reality that's incredibly incorrect. The mechanicalistic, reductionistic sort of orientation, you know, like the heart's a pump, and, you know, like you can, you know, that you use sort of physics as the base, foundational base for transaction with the universe, it's that in and of itself is what's producing so many of the ecological gyrations that we're experiencing. And, you know, the education system runs about 100 years behind, and it's just now that the real impact of nonlinearity, chaos theory, quantum mechanics, and all of that is sort of starting to really come to the fore as the foundational dynamic for how things work. And nonlinearity or self-organization of biological organisms is really the fundamental thing to understand, that the universe, you know, yeah, it has these sort of physics things you can look at, like gravity and stuff, but it also has a propensity to self-organize and form life in and of itself out of nothing. It's not, there's no reason for it. It just seems to be an inherent property here, just like gravity is an inherent property. And every time you get a life form that forms that way, the first thing that occurs right along with it is the creation of a neural network. The organism has to be able to tell the difference between itself and other organisms just simply to facilitate its survival. It has to, so when some other life form is approaching it, they have to be able to determine whether it's, you know, a beneficial approach, whether it's a hostile approach. They have to determine the meaning and the intent of the thing coming toward them. They have to then be able to analyze what's the likely outcome. They have to craft a response. They have to make future plans. You know, and when you start looking at everything like that, what you see is intelligence is an integral aspect of all life forms. And human beings just aren't very different. Our neural net, you know, the thing that, you know, people point to that say, oh, we're really more intelligent than everything else. But when I hear that, I always have to go, don't you guys ever read the newspapers or look at the news? I mean, human beings can't, you know, if you're saying that's the ultimate level of intelligence, then we're really in trouble.
Right. And it's so fun or funny if you look at the Amazon rainforest, or even not as an intense forest, the things that plants have created in order to survive. It's a jungle out there.
And when you start looking at it, there's new generations of people coming up now that aren't constrained by the old 19th century perspective. I think in part just because it's a different time, also because they see that old 19th century software program is not actually working very well, and they're looking at the world with fresh eyes, with the eyes of a four-year-old child, and it's taking them in these unique places. And so, you know, I go a lot into bacterial intelligence, where the most prominent researchers in the world are saying these are highly sentient beings that engage in tool making, that build cities, that create electricity to heat those cities, that care for their offspring, that have sophisticated language and culture. And then you see the same thing with plants. And people looking at the neural networks in plants, for instance, they begin to notice that the neural network of plants is nearly identical to our own. They use the same neurotransmitters. And it works, it has neural synapses and everything, it has memory storage. And basically what you get when you look at a human being, and people talk about the brain, you know, brain chauvinism, but our brain is only an organ that holds the neural network, all right? Well, for plants, it's the root system that is their brain, and the soil holds the neural net. They don't need a separate organ. And because, like, plants grow in the soil, plants many times, especially the ones that are perennials, they have neural networks that grow decade after decade, century after century, and end up far exceeding our own. Like some aspen root systems cover hundreds of acres and are over 100,000 years old. So they have a much greater capacity of thought than human beings will ever be able to possess. And it's only our sort of human-centric prejudice that has interfered with people being able to see that, as people in the Western countries, actually.
Yes, and boy, this opens up a huge can of worms, so to speak, in the sense that you talk about the bristlecone in your book and how over 5,000 years you talk, and then, you know, you talk about the human being who in less than 100 years is saying, I know everything that's needed, and the environmentalists who are maybe more myopic than many just by the fact that they think they can just step in after being alive for anywhere between 15 and 80 years and know exactly what shift needs to happen.
It's a real problem in that both the left and the right are guilty of tremendous hubris over and over and over again, and it's rare to find people that understand the depths of their ignorance enough that they proceed cautiously. And so, I mean, one of the things I talk about is invasive plants. And one of the jokes I continually make is, you know, well, the conservatives don't like illegal, you know, human immigrants, and they want to try to send them back where they came from. But, you know, the liberals hate invasive plant species, and they want to send them back to where they came from. And neither one is really looking at, you know, the deeper dynamics of things that are going on and trying to find a sustainable response. Well, invasive plant species move into new ecological systems, and they're moving over long timelines, and they invariably move into new areas in order to correct ecological damage that is in place, even if the human eye can't see it. It's a Gaian expression in response to destabilization of a healthy balance point in ecosystems. And the first question anybody needs to ask is, what are these invasive plants doing? But what we really do is we say, well, you know, it's displacing these other plants that are native here. You know, I mean, you have to understand, the earth is the earth. If a plant grows in China and, you know, it's native to the earth, so if it suddenly shows up in Vermont, it's still native. It's that there's something else going on, and we're just not looking at it with the proper eyes, actually.
Right. Well, with your eyes as an herbalist, I love that you did bring up, and of course you did, that these sometimes invasive species end up in an area where certain disease for man is showing up as well, that they can actually assist in. Not only
it's
for the earth.
It's a very specific thing that, I mean, you look at, for instance, so Isatis, which tends to be invasive, let's say, in Montana, and it moves into that region in response to overgrazing by cattle and sheep, and they don't like to eat it. It actually tastes a bit like spoiled cabbage, but they find it even more unpleasant. And basically, part of its function is to stop overgrazing so the rest of the system can begin to recover. But the other thing about Isatis is it's an extremely potent antiviral. It's one of the strongest ones. And so when you start to look at our, like, Ceta acuta is a very strong systemic antibacterial, which is invasive along the southern coast of the United States and the Gulf. And when you start to look at the kind of diseases that are moving into those regions, then you also start to find out that those plants tend to be specific for the diseases that are becoming endemic there. So there's this complex layering of function that's going on throughout the ecosystem in its movements. And I think one of the things that I bring up is that most of the Gaian movements will always remain opaque to our vision. We know less than 1% of really what's going on here. So we have to proceed with a lot of caution and begin to ask ourselves, well, why is this occurring? What is the dynamic? And just the thing that, oh, you know, the global warming and the invasive species are moving in to destroy our American way of life. It's just too simplistic.
Yes, and the whole global warming issue, which is creating its own brand of warriors, really. And once again, back to the bristlecone, is it planetary fluctuation? Are humans the enemy? And you've answered that quite a bit in your book by talking about ecological purpose and reasoning. And maybe you can go into that concerning human beings.
Well, that's one of the things is that, you know, for a long time, I suppose all of us that really care about the Earth and have any kind of a liberal sensitivity that way, that we all sort of start from the same place as we begin to sort of awaken from our kind of blindness. And one of the stages that we all go through is really seeing how the human species is fairly unable to restrain itself, no matter what area you look at, you know. And so we start to go, well, there's something wrong with the human species. And that particular focus, then pretty soon we get to, well, they're a cancer, they're a virus. You know, we'd all live really happy lives if all those people disappeared, you know, except for me and my friends, you know. And so that's sort of a dynamic we get into. You know, it's like looking for this heaven on earth thing, which is sort of part of the utopian power fantasies of Western science anyway. It's sort of, you know, the earthly, you know, mirror image of going to heaven during the rapture. And so, but the thing is, when you start to look deeper and you start to really understand the movements of Gaia, when you begin to genuinely trust nature and Gaia and understand Gaia is highly intelligent and has been at this business for 4.5 billion years, so you start to go, wait a second, maybe I ought to think differently. And, you know, I eventually understood that Gaia doesn't make mistakes, you know, not of this sort, not this late in the game, not this degree of error, that the human species must be doing something. And the important question is, what's the ecological function of the human species? And to me, the fact that the question has not been asked is astonishing. So I began to look more deeply at that over a very long period of time. And, you know, the kind of like feeling that human beings are a cancer stuff, it comes from deep concern, but nevertheless, it conceals a kind of form of self-hatred that a lot of people in the West struggle with. Whether you call it liberal guilt or whatever, there's this sort of dynamic that's in play. But if you give that up and you begin to ask, if you begin to trust nature and ask, why are human beings acting like this? Because you have to understand, Gaia does not generate new species out of, you know, I mean, it's not random. Gaia generates species every time in order to fulfill specific ecological functions, to, you know, help stabilize the self-organized state that the Earth is in and to modulate that in specific ways. Every organism has a function that way. And so to understand that the human species is responding to Gaian movements, it begins to change the whole tenor of the thing, and you start moving from a kind of a warrior dynamic to destroy the human enemy that's destroying the Earth, and you begin to move in a very different direction.
To be so dreamy and down to earth. Stephen Harrod Buhner, part 2 next week. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.